4. The San Domingo Masses begin.
Eh, eh, bomba, hui, hui, kanga bafiote, kanga munedele, kanga dokila, kanga dokila, kangali.
The slaves worked on the land, and like revolutionary peasants everywhere, they aimed at the extermination of their oppressors. But working and living together in gangs of hundreds on the huge sugar factories which covered the North Plain, they were closer to a modern proletariat than any group of workers in existence at the time. And the Rising was, therefore, a thoroughly prepared and organized mass movement. By hard experience, they had learned that isolated efforts were doomed to failure. And in the early months of 1791, in and around the Cap, they were organizing for revolution. Voodoo was the medium of the conspiracy. In spite of all prohibitions, the slaves traveled miles to sing and dance and practice the rites and talk. And now, since the revolution, to hear the political news and make their plans. Bukman, a papalois, or high priest, a gigantic Negro, was the leader. He was headman of a plantation and followed the political situation both among the whites and among the mulattoes. By the end of July 1791, the blacks in and around the Cap were ready and waiting. The plan was conceived on a massive scale, and they aimed at exterminating the whites and taking the colony for themselves. There were perhaps 12,000 slaves in the Cap, 6,000 of them men. One night, the slaves in the suburbs and outskirts of Le Cap were to fire the plantations. At this signal, the slaves in town would massacre the whites, and the slaves on the plain would complete the destruction. They had traveled a long, long way since the grandiose poisoning schemes of Macandal. The plan did not succeed in its entirety, but it very nearly did. And the scope and organization of this revolt shows Bukman to be the first of that line of great leaders whom the slaves were to throw up in such profusion and rapidity during the years which followed. That so vast a conspiracy was not discovered until it had actually broken out is a testimony to their solidarity. In early August, the slaves in Limbe, then and to the end of the revolution one of the storm centers, rose prematurely and were crushed. This Limbe Rising showed that it was dangerous to delay. 3 days after, representatives from parishes all over the plain assembled to fix the day. Deputies on their way to Le Cap for the first session of the Colonial Assembly, to begin on August 25th, met throngs of slaves on the road who abused and even attacked them. On August 21st, some prisoners were taken, and de Blancheland, the governor, examined them himself the next day. He did not get much from them, but he understood vaguely that there was to be some sort of rising. He took precautions to safeguard the city from the slaves within, and he ordered patrols to cover the outskirts. But these whites despised the slaves too much to believe them capable of organizing a mass movement on a grand scale. They could not get from the prisoners the names of the leaders, and what precautions could they take against the thousands of slaves on the hundreds of plantations? Some of the white rabble in Le Cap, always ready for loot and pillage, were revealed as being connected with a plot of some sort. De Blancheland was more concerned about these than about the Negroes. On the night of the 22nd, a tropical storm raged, with lightning and gusts of wind and heavy showers of rain. Carrying torches to light their way, the leaders of the revolt met in an open space in the thick forests of the Morne Rouge, a mountain overlooking Le Cap. There, Bukman gave the last instructions, and after voodoo incantations and the sucking of the blood of a stuck pig, he stimulated his followers by a prayer spoken in Creole, which, like so much spoken on such occasions, has remained. The God who created the sun which gives us light, who rouses the waves and rules the storm, though hidden in the clouds, he watches us. He sees all that the white man does. The God of the white man inspires him with crime, but our God calls upon us to do good works. Our God, who is good to us, orders us to revenge our wrongs. He will direct our arms and aid us. Throw away the symbol of the God of the whites who has so often caused us to weep, and listen to the voice of liberty, which speaks in the hearts of us all. The symbol of the God of the whites was the cross, which, as Catholics, they wore around their necks. That very night they began. The slaves on the Galafee plantation were so well treated that "happy as the Negroes of Galafee" was a slave proverb. Yet by a phenomenon noticed in all revolutions, it was they who led the way. Each slave gang murdered its masters and burnt the plantation to the ground. The precautions that de Blanchelande had taken saved Le Cap, but the preparation otherwise had been thorough and complete. And in a few days, one half of the famous North Plain was a flaming ruin. From Le Cap, the whole horizon was a wall of fire. From this wall continually rose thick black volumes of smoke, through which came tongues of flame leaping to the very sky. For nearly 3 weeks, the people of Le Cap could barely distinguish day from night, while a rain of burning cane straw, driven before the wind like flakes of snow, flew over the city and the shipping in the harbor, threatening both with destruction. The slaves destroyed tirelessly. Like the peasants in the Jacquerie or the Luddite Wreckers, they were seeking their salvation in the most obvious way, the destruction of what they knew was the cause of their sufferings. And if they destroyed much, it was because they had suffered much. They knew that as long as these plantations stood, their lot would be to labor on them until they dropped. The only thing was to destroy them. From their masters, they had known rape, torture, degradation, and, at the slightest provocation, death. They returned in kind. For 2 centuries, the higher civilization had shown them that power was used for wreaking your will on those whom you controlled. Now that they held power, they did as they had been taught. In the frenzy of the first encounters, they killed all. Yet they spared the priests whom they feared and the surgeons who had been kind to them. They, whose women had undergone countless violations, violated all the women who fell into their hands, often on the bodies of their still bleeding husbands, fathers, and brothers.
"Vengeance! Vengeance!" was their war cry.
And one of them carried a white child on a pike as a standard. And yet they were surprisingly moderate, then and afterwards, far more humane than their masters had been or would ever be to them. They did not maintain this revengeful spirit for long. The cruelties of property and privilege are always more ferocious than the revenges of poverty and oppression. For the one aims at perpetuating resented injustice, the other is merely a momentary passion soon appeased. As the revolution gained territory, they spared many of the men, women, and children whom they surprised on plantations. To prisoners of war alone, they remained merciless. They tore out their flesh with red-hot pincers. They roasted them on slow fires. They sawed a carpenter between 2 of his boards. Yet in all the records of that time, there is no single instance of such fiendish tortures as burying white men up to the neck and smearing the holes in their faces to attract insects, or blowing them up with gunpowder, or any of the 1,001 bestialities to which they had been subjected. Compared with what their masters had done to them in cold blood, what they did was negligible, and they were spurred on by the ferocity with which the whites in Le Cap treated all slave prisoners who fell into their hands. As usual, the strength of the mass movement dragged in its wake revolutionary sections of those classes nearest to it. Free blacks joined them. A planter of Port Magot had taught his black foreman to read and write, had made him free, had left him in his will 10,000 francs, had given to the foreman's mother
land on which she had made a coffee plantation. But this black raised the slaves on the plantations of his master and his own mother, set them on fire, and joined the revolution, which gave him a high command. The mulattoes hated the black slaves because they were slaves and because they were black. But when they actually saw the slaves taking action on such a grand scale, numbers of young mulattoes from Le Cap and roundabout rushed to join the hitherto despised blacks and fight against the common enemy. They were fortunate in that the troops in Le Cap were few, and de Blancheland, afraid of the slaves and the white rabble in the town, preferred to act on the defensive. One attack was made by the regulars, who drove the slaves before them, but de Blancheland, yielding to the nervous fears awakened in the city, recalled the detachment. This left the revolution master of the countryside. Gaining courage, the blacks extended their destruction over the plain. If they had had the slightest material interest in the plantations, they would not have destroyed so wantonly. But they had none. After a few weeks, they stopped for a moment to organize themselves. It is at this period, 1 month after the revolt had begun, that Toussaint Breda joined them and made an unobtrusive entrance into history. It seems certain that he had been in secret communication with the leaders, but like so many men of better education than the rank and file, he lacked their boldness at the moment of action and waited to see how things would go. Meanwhile, hating destruction, he kept his master's slaves in order and prevented the revolutionary laborers from setting fire to the plantation. While all the other whites in the neighborhood made a dash for Le Cap, Madame Bayou de Libertas remained on the plantation, protected by Toussaint. Bayou de Libertas himself was with a camp of planters not far off, on guard against the slaves, but came every day to the plantation. Toussaint, then as always master of himself and of all near to him, maintained this untenable situation for over a month. But as the insurrection grew, worn out by the strain of defending the property, his master and his mistress, and learning that Madame de Libertas's life was now in danger, he decided that the old life was over and a new one had begun. He told Madame de Libertas that the time had come for her to go to Le Cap, packed her and some valuables in a carriage, and sent her off under the care of his brother, Paul. He sent his own wife and the two children of the household into a safe spot in Spanish San Domingo. Then he slowly made his way to the camp of the revolted slaves. The man who so deliberately decided to join the revolution was 45 years of age, an advanced age for those times, gray already, and known to everyone as Old Toussaint. Out of the chaos in San Domingo that existed then, and for years to follow, he would lay the foundations of a Negro state that lasts to this day. From the moment he joined the revolution, he was a leader, and moved without serious rivalry to the first rank. We have clearly stated the vast impersonal forces at work in the crisis of San Domingo. But men make history, and Toussaint made the history that he made because he was the man he was. He had had exceptional opportunities, and both in mind and body was far beyond the average slave. Slavery dulls the intellect and degrades the character of the slave. There was nothing of that dullness or degradation in Toussaint. His post as steward of the livestock had given him experience in administration, authority, and intercourse with those who ran the plantation. Men who, by sheer ability and character, find themselves occupying positions usually reserved for persons of a different upbringing, education, and class, usually perform those duties with exceptional care and devoted labor. In addition to this practical education, he had, as we have seen, been able to read a little. He had read Caesar's commentaries, which had given him some idea of politics and the military art and the connection between them. Having read and reread the long volume by the Abbé Raynal on the East and West Indies, he had a thorough grounding in the economics and politics, not only of San Domingo, but of all the great empires of Europe which were engaged in colonial expansion and trade. Finally, he had had the exceptional experience of the last 3 years of the revolution in San Domingo. The plantation was only 2 miles from Le Cap, and his duties took him often into the town. The masses of the people learn much during a revolution, far more a man like Toussaint. His superb intellect had therefore had some opportunity of cultivating itself in general affairs at home and abroad. From the very beginning, he maneuvered with an uncanny certainty, not only between local parties in San Domingo, but between the international forces at work. An important thing for his future was that his character was quite unwarped. Since his childhood, he had probably never been whipped as so many slaves have been whipped. He himself tells us that he and his wife were among the fortunate few who had acquired a modest competence and used to go hand in hand and very happy to work on the little plot of land which some of the slaves cultivated for themselves. Besides his knowledge and experience, through natural strength of character, he had acquired a formidable mastery over himself, both mind and body. As a boy, he was so frail and delicate that his parents had not expected him to live, and he was nicknamed Little Stick. While still a child, he determined to acquire not only knowledge but a strong body, and he strengthened himself by the severest exercises, so that by the time he was 12, he had surpassed all the boys of his age on the plantation in athletic feats. He could swim across a dangerous river, jump on a horse at full speed, and do what he liked with it. When he was nearly 60, he was still the finest rider in San Domingo, habitually rode 125 miles a day, and sat his horse with such ease and grace that he was known as the centaur of the savannas. As a young man, he had run after women. Then he decided to settle down. Refusing to live in the concubinage which was so widely prevalent among all classes in San Domingo, but particularly among the slaves, he married a woman who already had a son. She bore Toussaint one child, and he and his wife lived together in the greatest harmony and friendship, when he was master of all San Domingo, just as in the days when he was an ordinary slave. For the life that so many lived in the colony, for the reputation that he had among the blacks and the opportunities that his position offered, this was an unusual thing for a man who had begun life as Toussaint had, and who, in the days of his greatness, was partial to the society of attractive women. From childhood, he had been taciturn, which singled him out among his countrymen, a talkative, argumentative people. He was very small, ugly and ill-shaped, but although his general expression was one of benevolence, he had eyes like steel, and no one ever laughed in his presence. His comparative learning, his success in life, his character and personality gave him an immense prestige among all the Negroes who knew him, and he was a man of some consequence among the slaves long before the revolution. Knowing his superiority, he never had the slightest doubt that his destiny was to be their leader, nor would those with whom he came in contact take long to recognize it. Nothing could be imagined more calculated to revolt his orderly mind than the spectacle which the slave camp presented. Many men were entirely naked. Others wore filthy rags made out of bits and pieces of silks and satins pillaged from the plantations. Their weapons were a few guns and pistols that they had seized, old rusty swords, agricultural implements, sticks pointed with iron, pieces of iron hoop, in fact, anything they could lay their hands on. They were destitute of ammunition, and the cavalry were mounted on old horses and mules worn down by fatigue. They were divided into two large bands, one under Biasu, the other under Jean-François, while a third leader was Jeannot. Jean-François was a native of San Domingo, good-looking, very intelligent, and of a proud spirit which had made him run away from his master and become a Maroon long before the revolution. In addition to his exceptional intelligence, he was very brave, very sober, and of a tenacity that never admitted defeat. Biasu was a fire eater, always drunk, always ready for the fiercest and most dangerous exploits. He also had had a life more easy than usual, having belonged to a religious establishment, the Fathers of Charity, not far from Le Cap. Jeannot was the slave who had led the foolish expedition of the San Domingo whites in the early days of the revolution, when, dressed up in their military uniforms, they had looked around for an enemy on whom to practice. Like their more educated white masters, the slaves hastened to deck themselves with all the trappings and titles of the military profession. The officers called themselves generals, colonels, marshals, commanders, and the leaders decorated themselves with scraps of uniforms, ribbons, and orders which they found on the plantations or took from the enemy killed in battle. Biasu called himself a brigadier. So did Jeannot. Later, Jean-Francois entitled himself, in the fashion of European colonial governors to this day, admiral, generalissimo, and chevalier of the Order of Saint-Louis. While Biasu, after a quarrel with Jean-Francois, assumed the title of Viceroy of the Conquered Territories. Yet, despite these absurdities, which served the same purpose of impressing their inferiors as the trappings, gold epaulettes, and multifarious commands of 20th century royalty, Jean-Francois and Biasu were men born to command. Nothing but an iron discipline could have kept order among that heterogeneous body of men just released from slavery. And Biasu and Jean-Francois imposed it with an iron hand. Jeannot was a cruel monster who used to drink the blood of his white victims and commit abominable cruelties. Jean-Francois arrested him, tried him, and had him shot, a conspicuous difference from the behavior of the white colonists in the case of Le Jeune. Jean-Francois soon foresaw a long war and ordered the planting of provisions. Thus, early the slave leaders were showing a sense of order, discipline, and capacity to govern. Many emissaries of the royalist counter-revolution found their way to the slaves. The priests, in large numbers, remained among them. But even the mulattoes failed to oust these black leaders, and Jean-Francois and Biasu, who were in command at the beginning of the revolution, remained masters of their respective bands to the end. Toussaint joined the band of Biasu. On account of his knowledge of herbs, Biasu appointed him physician to the armies of the king. And from the very beginning, Toussaint was high up in his councils. Masses roused to the revolutionary pitch need above all a clear and vigorous direction. But the first coup had failed, and Jean-Francois and Biasu, though they could keep order, had not the faintest idea what to do next. De Blanchelande sent them a proclamation demanding their submission. They refused, but in their reply called themselves the servants of God and the king, and naively invited the whites to take all their possessions and leave the island to those who had watered it with their sweat. To these bewildered political leaders, Toussaint brought his superior knowledge and the political vices which usually accompany it. The slaves had revolted because they wanted to be free. But no ruling class ever admits such things. The white cockades accused the patriots and the friends of the Negro of stirring up the revolt, while the red cockades accused the royalists and the counter-revolution in France. The small whites accused the mulattoes and massacred them at sight in the streets. The assembly took charge of the colony. It would not ask France for assistance, but sent envoys to the British at Jamaica, to the Spaniards, and to the United States. It did not fear the revolution. It was more afraid of the slaves in Le Cap and the city rabble, always ready to foment anarchy for the chance of plunder. These small whites refused to fight unless they were given 2/3 of what they found on the plantations as booty. But the majority of the mulattoes, anxious about their property, volunteered to serve and offered their wives and children as hostages in token of good faith. The assembly, knowing nothing as yet of the September 24th reversal, promised not only to enforce the decree of May 15th, but to extend it to all mulattoes whether their parents were free or not. But this could only be done, said the assembly, after the decree had reached the colony and when the troubles were over. To deceive the mulattoes, the planters were trying tricks. But against the slaves, they knew only one weapon, terror. The blacks had their stockades covered with the heads of white victims. The colonial assembly stuck the heads of Negroes on pikes placed all along the roads leading to Le Cap. When Boukman was killed, fighting bravely, the assembly stuck up his head in Le Cap with a placard. This is the head of Boukman, chief of the rebels. The whites built three scaffolds in Le Cap and broke 20 or 30 blacks on the wheel every day. With their usual disregard of the slave, even as property, they massacred all they met, even those on plantations which had not yet revolted. Masters denounced those who would help them to escape. Slaves presenting themselves to their masters seeking refuge from the devastation of the countryside, or merely because they were afraid or tired of revolution, were killed at sight. The result was that all, timid as well as bold, soon understood that there was no hope except with the revolution, and they flocked to join its ranks. In a few weeks, the insurgents had grown to nearly 100,000. To help the slaves and confuse the white planters came news of a mulatto revolution in the West. Early in August, a body of mulattoes, weary of being persecuted and lynched by the small whites, now lording it as officials in the revolutionary municipalities, crept out of Port-au-Prince and assembled at Le Croix de Bouquet, a district about 5 miles from the capital. From all parts of the West Province, the mulattoes began to send contingents there. And with their education, not so widespread as among the whites, but immensely superior to the half-wild blacks, they at once found admirable leadership. The most famous of them was Rigaud, a genuine mulatto, that is to say, the son of a white and a black. He had had a good education at Bordeaux and then learned the trade of a goldsmith. Unlike Toussaint, Jean-Francois, and Biassou, he was already a trained soldier. He had enlisted as a volunteer in the French army which fought in the American War of Independence, became a non-commissioned officer, and had also seen service in Guadeloupe. He hated the whites, not only for the indignities which he, an educated and widely traveled soldier, had to suffer, but also because they were jealous of his goldsmith's business, in those days an important trade. A very different type of man was Beauvais. He was a member of a mulatto family which had long been free and rich. He also had been educated in France, had volunteered for service and fought as a non-commissioned officer in the American War of Independence. On his return home, he had taken up teaching. He was not only a man of exceptional personal bravery. Tall, of a fine figure and distinguished presence, he was known as one of the handsomest men in San Domingo. And in that licentious age and country, he was distinguished for the severity of his mode of life and the charm of his manners. His own people loved him, and it would not be difficult for the whites, when in a corner, to forget his color. These were the two soldiers. The politician was Pinchinat, who had studied widely in France. In the first days of the revolution, he came back to San Domingo to lead the mulattoes. In 1791, he was already 60. A man loving play and loose living, and hating the whites with all the hatred of a vicious character. He was a most finished politician and well deserved the qualification of man of genius, given to him by Pamphile de Lacroix. What a man to write and to make treaties, another mulatto leader would write of him. He is unique. Under such leaders, and trained to fight in the Marais Chaussee, the mulattoes were a formidable force. For this reason, the royalist counter-revolution in the West at once sought to make use of them. Oumou de Jumcourt, commandant of the district of La Croix des Bouquets and cul-de-sac, proposed an alliance guaranteeing them all their rights in return for support of the counter-revolution, or, as he would call it, the lawful government of the island. Pinchina refused, but offered instead a united front against their common enemy, the municipality of Port-au-Prince and the Provincial Assembly of the West. De Jumcourt agreed, and the royalist commandants and the rich whites of the West began to join the mulattoes at La Croix des Bouquets. There were a few free blacks holding high command in this troop, so that despised blacks were now commanding whites. The mulattoes also incorporated in their force a body of Maroons, nicknamed the Swiss in imitation of the bodyguard of Louis XVI. Full of contempt for men of color, and hating them now for their persistent royalism, the patriots attacked La Croix des Bouquets. They were heavily defeated, the Swiss fighting with great bravery. A few days later, the mulattoes and the whites of the surrounding districts had a meeting at La Croix des Bouquets, where the mulattoes put before the whites the draft of a concordat embodying their demands for complete equality. The ninth and last clause consisted of four words: if not, civil war. The whites accepted their demands immediately. The patriots of San Domingo were always ready to forget race prejudice in return for something solid. After he had been defeated in the field, Caradieu, leader of the patriots, offered Beauvais mulatto rights in return for an agreement on independence without the intervention of the royalists. Beauvais refused. By this time, nearly all the rich planters had deserted the patriots, and even the rich merchants in Port-au-Prince would have nothing to do with them. On October 19th, a concordat embodying all the mulatto demands was signed by all parties. The Provincial Assembly of the West was to be dissolved immediately. The white deputies from the West Province to the Colonial Assembly were to be recalled. Two battalions of the National Guard were to be recruited among the mulattoes. The memory of Auger was to be rehabilitated, and the whole presented for the ratification of the National Assembly and the approval of the King. The leader of the whites extended the hand of friendship. "We bring you finally words of peace. We come no longer to bargain with you. We come only to accord to your demands. We come animated by the spirit of justice and peace to give you authentic recognition of your rights, to ask you to see in the white citizens only friends and brothers whom the colony in danger invites you, begs you, to unite with, in order to bring prompt assistance to our troubles. We accept entirely and without any reserve the concordat that you propose to us. Unfortunate circumstances of which you are doubtless aware made us hesitate for a moment, but our courage has broken all obstacles, and we have imposed silence on all mean prejudices, on the petty desire for domination. May the day on which the torch of reason has enlightened us all be forever memorable. May it be a day of forgetfulness for all errors, of pardon for all injuries. Let us henceforth be combatants only in zeal for the public welfare. The mean prejudices and the petty desire for domination were the small whites who saw themselves being pushed into the background. But the news of the slave revolution in the North had sobered all who owned slaves, and they wanted peace. All the 14 parishes of the West Province accepted the terms, and on the 24th of October, the great ceremony of reconciliation took place in Port-au-Prince. The leaders of the whites and the leaders of the mulattoes marched into Port-au-Prince arm in arm, with their troops marching behind, greeted by salvos of artillery and mutual shouts of unity and fidelity. In the general excitement, a captain of the White National Guard jumped on a gun carriage and proclaimed Caradieu commander of the National Guard of the West Province. There was loud applause, which was renewed when he named Beauvais second in command. Then all went to the church to celebrate with a Te Deum, as stipulated in the Concordat. One more difficulty remained. The Swiss. What was to be done with them? The whites argued that to send them back to the plantations would be bad for the slaves, and it was agreed to deport them to a deserted beach in Mexico. Among the leaders, Rigaud and Pétion, mulattoes, fought for the Swiss. Lambert, a free black, supported the deportation. The Swiss out of the way, peace seemed assured, mulatto rights guaranteed, and the counter-revolution well placed for action. But in Le Cap, the assembly foamed with wrath at these going-ons in the West. The royalist commanders of the local forces, Monsieur de Rouvray and Monsieur de Tuzal, urged the patriots in the North to grant mulatto rights. But, you will say, must we yield to the menaces of an inferior caste? Admit it to civic rights as a ransom for the evils which they cause us? One day, said de Rouvray, the scornful laughs with which you greet the important truths which I dare to tell you will change into tears of blood. In the War of 1756, England wished to seize Cuba, and Lord Albemarle was ordered to besiege Havana. He landed with 18,000 men. 6 months after, he only had 1,800. Where, I ask you, is the army capable of fulfilling our aim? Have you any others than the mulattoes? No. Well, why do you reject the help which they offer you? I am not finished. I have some other truths to tell you. I shall tell them to you. France at this moment has her eyes fixed on San Domingo. It is impossible that the claims of the mulattoes will not be listened to in France. If even they were unjust, they will be welcomed. The constitutional decree that you suppose irrevocable, that you regard as your palladium, will be inevitably modified. The assembly promised to give the mulattoes their rights, but after the troubles were over. True, there was a slave revolt, but they had appealed to France by now, and to give rights to mulattoes who outnumbered them would be to hand over the colony, military and civil, to these bastard upstarts and their allies of the counter-revolution. They could see the results of that unholy alliance in the West. They had de Blanchelon, the governor, in their power, and they poured out their wrath on the Concordat. The West would not budge from their unity and repudiated the proclamations of the assembly and the governor. But 6 days after the ceremony of reconciliation, there arrived in the colony the decree of the 24th September, by which the constituent had withdrawn all rights from the mulattoes and once more put their fate in the hands of the white colonists. Mean prejudices and the petty desire for domination reared heads again, and the scarcely healed wounds reopened. The intrigues of Barnave and company were coming home to roost. The 21st November was fixed for the ratification of the Concordat. Port-au-Prince was divided into four sections for the voting, and three had already voted in favor of ratification. This, for the small whites, was ruin, and Prelato and his band were on the lookout to create some cause for a breach. It came over a free Negro, a member of the mulatto force, who was either insulted by or insulted some whites. He was immediately captured and hanged. Despite the moderation of the mulattoes, fighting began in the streets. The mulattoes, taken by surprise, retreated. Fire broke out in the city, for which they were made responsible. Prelato and his followers massacred rich white citizens, mulattoes, men, women, and children, and plundered the wealthy quarter of the town, while the flames spread and burned two-thirds of Port-au-Prince to the ground, estimated at a loss of 50 million francs. The mulattoes had been very patient and forbearing, but now they seemed to go mad. Pinchina, the man of proclamations, issued a ringing call for battle. Fly, my friends, to the siege of Port-au-Prince, and let us plunge our bleeding arms, avengers of perjury and perfidy, into the breast of these monsters from Europe. Too much and too long have we served as sport for their passions and their insidious maneuvers. Too much and too long have we groaned under this iron yoke. Let us destroy our tyrants. Let us bury with them even the smallest vestige of our degradation. Let us tear up by its deepest roots this upas tree of prejudice. Recruit some, persuade others, promise, menace, threaten, drag in your wake the decent white citizens. But above all, dear friends, unity, courage, and speed. Bring arms, baggage, cannon, munitions of war, and provisions, and come at once to rally under the common standard. It is there that we all ought to perish, or take vengeance for God, nature, law, and humanity, so long outraged in these climates of horror. Rigaud's brother wrote to his friends, I fly to vengeance. If my fate is not death on this expedition, I shall be back soon to join you. Long live liberty. Long live equality. Long live love. Rich whites and royalist commandants followed the mulattoes, but the Rigaud brothers, Beauvais and Pinchinet, despite his treatment of the Swiss, were genuine revolutionaries, putting liberty before property. In a frenzy of excitation and rage, they summoned the slaves of the West Province and drew them into the revolution. In the advanced North, the slaves were leading the mulattoes. In the backward West, the mulattoes were leading the slaves. It does not need much wisdom to foresee the consequences. In the South, whites and mulattoes were on the point of forming a concordat on the model of the West. All terms had been agreed upon when Caradeau paid a visit to the South and intrigued so successfully that the unity agreement was broken. As soon as the news of the split in Port-au-Prince reached them, mulattoes and whites each took to arms. The mulattoes made themselves masters of Jacmel and other towns. In self-defense, the whites in the South, outnumbered by the mulattoes, raised the slaves. In the North, some mulatto and white proprietors formed a concordat. The assembly disallowed it, and these mulattoes joined the slaves. The whites committed frightful atrocities against the mulattoes. They killed a pregnant woman, cut the baby out, and threw it into the flames. They burnt them alive. They inoculated them with smallpox. Naturally, the mulattoes retaliated in kind. But here, as everywhere, the white planters began it and exceeded all rivals in barbarism, being trained in violence and cruelty by their treatment of the slaves. This was the San Domingo that the three commissioners, Saint-Léger, Mirbeck, and Roume, were to restore to order when they landed at Le Cap on November 29, 1791. They were welcomed by the assembly and installed with an imposing ceremony. They issued a proclamation mandatiously announcing the near arrival of large bodies of troops. To their surprise and joy, this seemed as if it would work a miracle. Biassou, Jean-Francois, and the other Negro leaders, including Toussaint, after 4 months of insurrection, had come to a dead end. An insurrection must win victories, and the whites were content to hold the line of fortifications known as the Cordon of the West and prevent the insurrection penetrating into the West Province. The former slaves could devastate the country around, but that very devastation was making it impossible for them to exist. Famine began to kill them off. Frightened at what they considered their hopeless position, and afraid of being beaten into submission, Jean-Francois and Biassou offered peace to the commissioners in return for the liberty of a few hundred leaders. Jean-Francois knew that it was a betrayal. False principles, wrote this 4 months-old labor leader, will make these slaves very obstinate. They will say that they have been betrayed. But if the commissioners granted liberty to those who were named, they would cooperate with the king's troops and hunt down those who refused to submit. Jean-Francois knew that the business would be difficult and dangerous, and said as much. proof of the passion for liberty which filled the hearts of the blacks. But he was prepared to do all that he could to help, and to soothe his conscience, wrote disloyally of his followers as a multitude of Negroes from Africa who did not know two words of French. In the long and cruel list of leaders betraying brave but ignorant masses, this stands high, and Toussaint was in it up to the neck. Though working in a subordinate position, he took the leading part in the negotiations, and the masterpiece of diplomatic correspondence which the envoys of the slaves presented at the bar of the assembly showed the distance between the men who a few weeks before had asked the whites to leave the island and the already fully-fledged political maturity of Toussaint. To the end of his days, he could hardly speak French. He literally could not write three words without the grossest errors in spelling and grammar. Years afterwards, when he was master of San Domingo, he wrote thus to Dessalines: "Je vous avais parlé pour le folie Berthe avant tiré." He meant to write, "Je vous avais parlé de Fort Liberté avant-hier." He could never do better. But he dictated in the local bastard French or Creole, and his secretaries wrote and rewrote until he got the exact meaning he wanted. The letter begins by emphasizing that the King's proclamation has formally accepted the French Constitution, and very clearly and precisely has asked for a spirit of justice and moderation to help in the restoration of a country which has suffered from the repeated shocks of a great revolution. This conciliatory spirit should cross the seas. We pass now to the law relating to the colonies of September 28, 1791. This law gives to the colonies the right of deciding on the status of the free men of color and free blacks. Toussaint and the other traitors wanted not only freedom, but political rights. But promises were not enough. They would defend the decisions of the colonial assembly to the last drop of their blood. But these decisions must be clothed with the requisite formalities, followed a long apology for the evils which they had helped to afflict on this rich and important colony. But they had not known of the new laws when they had written the first letter. Today, when we are instructed in the new laws, today, when we cannot doubt the approbation of the mother country for all the legislative acts that you will decree, concerning the interior regime of the colony and the status of citizens, we shall not show ourselves refractory. After another long appeal to the assembly to seize this opportunity to reestablish order promptly in so important a colony, the letter touched on the difficult question of the slaves. "The laws which will be enforced concerning the status of persons free and not free ought to be the same in the whole colony." This was obviously a finger pointing to the concordats in the West Province. "It will be even to your interest if you declared, by a decree bearing the sanction of the governor, that it is your intention to concern yourselves with the lot of the slaves, knowing that they are the object of your solicitude." Inasmuch as the slaves had confidence in their chiefs, if the assembly gave the job of pacification to these chiefs, the slaves would be satisfied, which would facilitate restoration of the equilibrium which has been broken. The conclusion was a protestation of good faith and desire for a speedy settlement. Freedom for the leaders, however, was indispensable. The letter was signed by Jean-François and Biassou, two others, and two commissioners ad hoc, one of whom was Toussaint. In its skillful use of both the moral and political connection between the mother country and the colony, its dangling before the colonists the chance to restore the former prosperity of this great and important colony, its firm but delicate insistence on political rights, duly certified by law, for the freedmen, its luxuriance whenever it dealt with things that cost nothing as peace, goodwill, etc., the letter could have come from the pen of a man who had spent all his life in diplomacy. The writer, knowing the temper of the colonists, had even taken the trouble to suggest to them exactly how the slaves were to be bluffed back into bondage. No imperialist of today with 300 years of traditional deception behind him could have garlanded his claws with fairer words. The restoration of the broken equilibrium, as a phrase for slavery, would not have disgraced the Mandates Commission of the League of Nations. Jean-Francois had written that the thing was difficult, but it could be done, and that they were not only prepared but able to do their Judas work. The letter gave ample evidence. Political treachery is not a monopoly of the white race, and this abominable betrayal so soon after the insurrections shows that political leadership is a matter of program, strategy, and tactics, and not the color of those who lead it, their oneness of origin with their people, nor the services they have rendered. The high and mighty colonists refused. Treat with these brigands who had murdered and burnt and raped? Impossible. In vain the commissioners protested. The colonists, supremely confident that they would without difficulty drive these revolted dogs back to their kennels, answered that they would grant pardon only to repentant criminals who returned to work. The message ended with the terse request to the envoys, "Get out." The white colonists could not understand that Biasu was no longer a slave, but a leader of 40,000 men. When he got this message, he lost his temper and remembered the white prisoners. "I shall make them pay for the insolence of the assembly which has dared to write to me with so little respect," and ordered them all to be killed. Toussaint, always a hater of unnecessary bloodshed, calmed his chief. The disappointed commissioners arranged an interview with Jean-Francois. The colonial assembly accused them of plotting counter-revolution. The commissioners invited them to send delegates. At the appointed place and time, Jean-Francois appeared, leading his horse by the bridle. At the sight of him, Monsieur Boulet, a colonist, was so overpowered with rage that he struck him with a riding whip. Jean-Francois, fiercely angry, fell back to his own band, and peace hung on a thread. At this dangerous moment, Saint-Léger had the quick-wittedness and courage to advance alone among the hostile blacks and speak to them kindly. So moved were they at this unexpected behavior that Jean-Francois threw himself at the feet of the men from France. He reiterated his promise. For the freedom of 400 of the leaders and forgetfulness of the past, he would lead the blacks back to slavery. The commissioners asked him, as a guarantee of good faith, to return the white prisoners. He agreed and asked to return for his wife, a prisoner in Le Cap, whom the whites had not dared to execute for fear of reprisals. The interview ended amicably, Jean-Francois assuring the commissioners that he was touched to see at last white men who showed humanity. Next day, he sent the promised prisoners to Le Cap. But the blacks had probably got to know that something was in the wind. The prisoners were under a strong escort, including Toussaint, which was scarcely sufficient to save them from the hostility of those they met on the way. The members of the delegation presented themselves at the bar of the assembly. The president would not even speak to them, but communicated with them only by note. "Continue to give proof of your repentance, and say to those who send you," to address themselves to the commissioners, "it is only by their intercession that the assembly can come to a decision on your fate." He wanted to impress on the blacks that the commissioners were subordinate to the assembly, and he succeeded. So disdainful was the assembly that it would not include the negotiations in the minutes. Toussaint had plenary powers, and in a vain attempt to break down the pride of the colonists, he secretly reduced the number to be freed from 400 to 60. The colonists would not hear of it. Then, and only then, did Toussaint come to an unalterable decision from which he never wavered, and for which he died. Complete liberty for all, to be attained and held by their own strength. The most extreme revolutionaries are formed by circumstances. It is probable that, looking at the wild hordes of blacks who surrounded him, his heart sank at the prospect of the war and the barbarism which would follow freedom, even if it were achieved. He was ready to go a long way to meet the colonists. He probably hoped for some attempt at better treatment. But having been driven to take his decision, as was his way, he never looked back. On his return, he told his chiefs not to look to the commissioners for anything. They had only a faculty of intercession, and their powers were subordinate to those of the assembly. Biasu, who had demanded an interview, evaded it. Henceforth, it was war, and war needed trained soldiers. Toussaint dropped his post of physician to the armies of the king, and assuming the title of brigadier general, started to train an army. Once only in his political life did he ever fail to meet an emergency with action bold and correct. In the West Province, Rigaud, Beauvais, and Pinchinet were using as their agent in the gangs a young slave named Hyacinthe. He was only 21 years of age, but he went from plantation to plantation claiming, as most leaders of agricultural revolts, that he was divinely inspired. We can judge the backwardness of the Western slaves at the beginning of the revolution from the fact that both Hyacinthe and another man, Romaine, the prophetess, fortified their authority with divine attributes, while Jean-Francois and Biasu in the north from the very beginning aimed at social revolution. The blacks flocked to join the Confederate army of mulattoes and whites at La Croix des Bouquets, and on March 31st, the battle between the Confederates and the Patriots of Port-au-Prince took place. The slaves were nearly all native-born Africans. Armed only with knives, picks, hoes, and sticks with iron points, they went into battle. Led by Hyacinthe, they charged the bayonets of the Port-au-Prince volunteers and the French soldiers without fear or care for the volleys from Prelato's cannon which tore their ranks. If they were killed, they would wake again in Africa. Hyacinthe, a bull's tail in his hand, ran from rank to rank crying that his talisman would chase death away. He charged at their head, passing unscathed through the bullets and the grape shot. Under such leadership, the Africans were irresistible. They clutched at the horses of the dragoons and pulled off the riders. They put their arms down into the mouths of the cannon in order to pull out the bullets and called to their comrades, "Come, come, we have them." The cannons were discharged and blew them to pieces. But others swarmed over guns and gunners, threw their arms around them, and silenced them. Nothing could stop their devotion. And after 6 hours, the troops of Port-au-Prince retired in disorder. They had lost over 100 soldiers, but nearly 2,000 slaves lay dead upon the field. The combined army then invested Port-au-Prince. The whites were not only fighting with the mulattoes, but were petitioning the governor to prevent disturbers of the peace coming from the colonial assembly to disrupt the West. They sent him the concordats. They said they would stick to them whatever he said. They asked him to publish them, to send them to the king, to the legislative in France, to the merchants of the great ports, to everybody. Whatever the reservations they had made when they formed this pact with the bastard mulattoes, the whites were now eager to cement the alliance, and Rome was overwhelmed by the number of these appeals. Revolution, says Karl Marx, is the locomotive of history. Here was a locomotive that had traveled at remarkable speed. For in April 1792, not yet 3 years after the fall of the Bastille, the white patriots in Port-au-Prince were being besieged by a composite army of royalist commandants, white planters, brown-skinned mulattoes, and black slaves, none of them constrained, but all for the time being, free and equal partners. No doubt most of the rich were only awaiting the restoration of order, to put the slaves back in their places again. But the mere fact of the revolutionary association and the temporary equality meant that the old spell was broken, and things would never be the same again. The colonial assembly, in addition to war with the slaves and war with the mulattoes, had started a fierce row with the commissioners over precedence. In Le Cap, the patriots actually had the governor under arrest for some time and were plotting to murder Mirbeck, who sailed for home on February 30th. Saint-Léger had gone to Port-au-Prince. The patriots there, spurred on by the assembly in Le Cap, threatened to deport him, and he took refuge with the Confederates. Saint-Léger and Roume were now seriously alarmed, not at revolting slaves, but at the growth of the counter-revolution. In the same way as Barnave, the Lemettes, and their friends in France, white San Domingo was growing tired of the red cockade and beginning to look once more to the royal authority. The Confederate army seemed all white cockade. But just at this time, Pinchinat had a meeting with Saint-Léger, and what he told that gentleman made him fly post-haste to France. Roume also was due to leave 3 days after, but in a chance conversation, he smelled a royalist plot and stayed to ward it off. The royalists indeed thought that San Domingo was now ripe for the picking, but they were mistaken. Pinchinat had played an astute game. The royalists had hoped to use the mulattoes. Now they found that they had been used instead. As Beauvais told Roume afterwards, "We were never the dupes of the white cockades. We had to conquer our rights. We needed auxiliaries. If the devil had presented himself, we would have enrolled him. These gentlemen offered, and we used them, while allowing them to believe that we were their dupes." The decree of April 4th now came to clinch the victory of the mulattoes and allow them openly to support the French Revolution, for a time. The colonial question had frayed the nerves and exhausted the constituent, all of whose members were excluded by law from the legislative which met on October 1st. The new deputies were no better off as far as the colonial question was concerned, for in addition to the rights of man for mulattoes, they now faced a slave revolt. On the right were the Feuillants, or King's Party, led on the colonial question by Vaublanc, who approved the condition of slaves, even mulattoes. The left was stronger since the elections. But though there were over 100 Jacobin deputies in the legislative, they were split. On the extreme left were Robespierre and the Mountain. On the right were the Brissotins, or followers of Brissot, better known in history as the Girondins. The Paris masses, organized in the Commune, were following the Jacobins. Robespierre and the Mountain would fight for mulatto rights. So would Brissot. But Brissot's group was composed of Vergniaud, Gaudet, and others, actual deputies of the maritime towns. The Girondins were so called after the Gironde province, whose chief town was Bordeaux. Vergniaud was deputy for Bordeaux, and all the maritime towns were still firmly against the rights of man for mulattoes. What first frightened them was the way the news of the insurrection reached France. Paris heard of it from an English paper. The English ambassador gave information about the seriousness of the uprising. He had got it from Jamaica through London. The Moniteur, day after day, asked, "Why no news from de Blancheland?" On November 7th, the Moniteur printed a copy of the letter the colonists had written to the governor of Jamaica. Only on the 8th was a letter from de Blancheland asking for troops read in the house. The maritime bourgeois began to look at these colonists with a different eye. The mulattoes, at least, were faithful to France, and they were strong supporters of slavery. The first question was for troops to quell the revolt. But in a revolution, the revolution comes first. Right and left wing of the legislative wanted to know how many troops were to be sent and who would control them. The king was still head of the army and navy. The officers were royalist and centers of the counter-revolution. The king's ministers and officials were still functioning, in Paris and in San Domingo. To put an army and a fleet into the hands of these people was to be putting weapons which, after the suppression of the insurrection, perhaps before, might be used against the revolution itself, and place the richest colony of France entirely in royalist hands. Jacobins and Feuillants fought it out day after day. But though it was a question of repressing a slave revolt, the legislative, like the constituent, would not tolerate the use of the word slave. When a deputy in the course of a speech happened to say, "But the slaves are the property of the colonists," there were the usual protests and demands that the speaker be called to order. The legislative, more to the left, was, perhaps for this reason, even more sensitive than the constituent. The Colonial Commission, wishing as usual to have everything settled in the ministry, would not make any report. But the Friends of the Negro were far more powerful now, and Brissot gave warning. If the commission did not present its report in 10 days, he was going to open a debate on December 1st. During the interval, delegates from the Colonial Assembly arrived in Paris. And on November 30th, one of them, Millet, put the colonists' case. It is probable that never, in any parliamentary assembly, was so much impudent lying and dishonesty packed into any single speech. Millet's description of slavery proved it to be the happiest form of society known in either ancient or modern times. "We live in peace, gentlemen, in the midst of our slaves. Let an intelligent and educated man compare the deplorable state of these men in Africa with the pleasant and easy life which they enjoy in the colonies. Sheltered by all the necessities of life, surrounded with an ease unknown in the greater part of the countries of Europe, secure in the enjoyment of their property, for they had property and it was sacred, cared for in their illnesses with an expense and an attention that you would seek in vain in the hospitals so boasted of in England, protected, respected in the infirmities of age, in peace with their children and with their family, freed when they had rendered important services. Such was the picture, true and not embellished, of the government of our Negroes. And this domestic government perfected itself particularly during the last 10 years, with a care of which you will find no model in Europe. The most sincere attachment bound the master to the slave. We slept in safety in the middle of these men who had become our children, and many among us had neither locks nor bolts on our doors." This was supposed to be the lot of the slaves up to 1787, the year before the Lejeune case. Terror? To keep the slaves in subjection, attested in 1,000 documents? No such thing. True, there were a small number of hard and ferocious masters. But what was the lot of these wicked men? Branded by public opinion, looked upon with horror by all honest people, shut out from all society, without credit in their business, they lived in opprobrium and dishonor, and died in misery and despair. What was it that changed this idyllic state of affairs? At this point, enter the villain. However, gentlemen, a society takes shape in the bosom of France and prepares from afar the destruction and the convulsions to which we are subjected. And far from being able to continue with our work, this society forced us to renounce it by sowing the spirit of insubordination among our slaves and anxiety among us. Having hurled his bomb at the Friends of the Negro, Millet turned to the assembly itself. He knew the tender spot. "Soon, they say, the society will demand that the slave trade be suppressed. That is to say, that the profits which can result from it for French commerce will be delivered to foreigners. For never will its romantic philosophy persuade all the powers of Europe that it is their duty to abandon the cultivation of the colonies, and to leave the inhabitants of Africa a prey to the barbarity of their tyrants, rather than to employ them elsewhere." under kind masters, they exploit a territory which would remain uncultivated without them, and of which the rich productions are, for the nations which possess them, a great source of industry and of prosperity. The mulattoes? They and the whites had lived peacefully, nay, happily. The bonds of affection and of good feeling which existed between these two classes of men would be strengthened by the just and humane laws a colonial assembly would pass. But here, too, the friends of the Negro falsely represented the attitude of the whites as the pretensions of vanity and an endeavor to resist just claims. But no man can keep it up forever, least of all men trained in the French intellectual tradition. Before Millet concluded, he suddenly let slip the elegant drapery and gave a glimpse of white San Domingo in all its bloated nakedness. These coarse men, the blacks, are incapable of knowing liberty and enjoying it with wisdom, and the imprudent law which would destroy their prejudices would be for them and for us a decree of death. The legislature listened in silence. This was no juggling with the word slavery. It was the thing itself, presented to the bourgeoisie for their endorsement through all eternity. Jaurès notes that there was no applause, none even of those disgusted interruptions with which the legislative was wont to express its disapproval of the mere word slavery. When Millet was finished, the president invited the delegates to the honors of the session. But this was too much. One of the extreme left jumped up in a rage. What, Mr. President? You invite to the session men who have just outraged philosophy and liberty, men who have just insulted. But the profits of the slave trade were too much for the assembly, and the left itself had no heart for this business. Next day, Brissot took the floor, and on behalf of the mulattoes, made a masterly and celebrated speech. He showed the rich whites anxious to have peace and ready to give political rights to the mulattoes. The patriots, for the most part heavily indebted to France and bent on independence, jealous of the mulattoes who did not owe, and determined to maintain the privilege of race, all the more dear to them, in that it rested now on such insecure foundation. It is by this that we can explain the existence all at the same time in the heart of the same colonist, of hatred against the man of color who claims his rights, against the merchant who claims his debts, against a free government which wishes that justice be done to all. Once more, the bourgeoisie battled over mulatto rights. This time, the contest lasted for weeks, in and out of the house. Vaublanc took the place of the absent Barnave, but the friends of the Negro had a new argument in the concordats between whites and mulattoes, and the maritime bourgeois were now convinced that the only way to save the colony was to give the mulattoes their rights. The negotiations of the patriots with other countries had opened their eyes as to the real nature of these gentlemen. Vergniaud and Gaudet were able to convince their patrons that the old policy was false. The great shipowners, merchants and traders, threw over the colonists. Barnave's group, the Feuillants, formed the governing ministry, but the revolution was taking courage again. The Feuillants were overthrown on March 10th, and a Girondin ministry came in, with Roland at its head, but Madame Roland and Brissot as its leading spirits. On March 24th, by a large majority, the legislative passed a decree, giving full political rights to the men of color. Some tried to argue that the decisions of the constituent were sacrosanct, but a deputy of the left, to the accompaniment of great applause, challenged the theory that the legislative was forever bound by the decrees of the constituent and boldly asserted the sovereignty of the people over the rights of formal assemblies. Three new commissioners were appointed with supreme powers and large forces to enforce the decree and restore order. And on April 4th, the king's signature made the decree law. But what of the slaves? The slaves had revolted for freedom. The revolt was to be suppressed. but at least there might be a promise of pardon, a kind treatment in the future? Not a word, neither from Vaublanc on the right nor Robespierre on the left. Robespierre made an ass of himself by violently objecting to the word slavery when proposed as a substitute for non-free. Brissot made a passing reference to them as being unfortunate, and that was all. The cause of the men of color is then the cause of the patriots of the old Third Estate, and finally of the people so long oppressed. So had spoken Brissot, and Brissot, representative of the Third Estate, was prepared to help the Third Estate of the mulattoes and give the people, in France as well as in San Domingo, phrases. The French peasants were still clamoring for the assembly to relieve them of the feudal dues. The Brissotins would not do it. They would not touch property, and the slaves were property. Blanquetti, a deputy, proposed a motion for gradual enfranchisement. The legislative would not even discuss it. On March 26th, 2 days after the decree in favor of the mulattoes, Ducos dared to propose that every mulatto child be free, whatever the status of its mother. The legislative, in wrath, voted the previous question, and Ducos was not even allowed to speak on his motion. The Friends of the Negro, good liberals, were now in power and were as silent about slavery as any colonist. The slaves, ignorant of politics, had been right not to wait on these eloquent phrase makers. Toussaint, that astute student of French politics, read and noted. Toussaint alone among the black leaders, with freedom for all in his mind, was in those early months of 1792 organizing out of the thousands of ignorant and untrained blacks an army capable of fighting European troops. The insurgents had developed a method of attack based on their overwhelming numerical superiority. They did not rush forward in mass formation like fanatics. They placed themselves in groups, choosing wooded spots in such a way as to envelop their enemy, seeking to crush him by weight of numbers. They carried out these preliminary maneuvers in dead silence while their priests, the black ones, chanted the Wanga, and the women and children sang and danced in a frenzy. When these had reached the necessary height of excitement, the fighters attacked. If they met with resistance, they retired without exhausting themselves. But at the slightest hesitation in the defense, they became extremely bold, and, rushing up to the cannon, swarmed all over their opponents. At first, they could not even use the guns they captured, and used to apply the match at the wrong end. It was from these men, unable to speak two words of French, that an army had to be made. Toussaint could have had thousands following him. It is characteristic of him that he began with a few hundred picked men, devoted to himself, who learnt the art of war with him from the beginning, as they fought side by side against the French troops and the colonists. In camp, he drilled and trained them assiduously. By July 1792, he had no more than 500 attached to himself, the best of the revolutionary troops. These, and not the perorations in the legislative, would be decisive in the struggle for freedom. But nobody took much notice of Toussaint and his black followers. Feuillants and Jacobins in France, whites and mulattoes in San Domingo, were still looking upon the slave revolt as a huge riot which would be put down in time, once the division between the slave owners was closed.